I'm here with Shiv Getu from Zuma. Zuma is a leasing application in multifamily. We're going to chat about getting Hell Yes. And one of the exciting things to talk about with what Shiv's up to is just all the work that you've been doing in terms of going coast to coast, all the folks you've been chatting with. Some of your podcasts and lives have been just emotional. It's been outstanding. So I think that everyone needs to be thankful for the work that you're doing there. From listing, getting to Hell Yes, we always talk about the buyer's journey. We talk about, you know, how is sellers responding to the modern buyer's journey with respect to meeting where they're at, meeting them where they're, you know, in their moment of problem solving, how we communicate those problems, how we get those problems, how we kind of like dig in on them so they close and convert, because ultimately we got to sell something. This is brought to you by IRCX. We're AI remote maintenance software, property management. Folks, if you're listening and online, we'd love to get questions and engagement throughout. That's always super helpful. And those are the rules of engagement. And as we always kick things off, Shiv, love to hear a little bit about your background. I saw you have a consulting background. So, hey, cheers to that. And how did you end up in this role?
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me, Guillermo. This is going to be fun. This is my first LinkedIn Live since I've been trying to be a pseudo LinkedIn influencer. So excited to do this. I fell into this role very happenstance. My co-founder and I both went to USC, have been friends for a while. And after graduating, I worked at consulting. But while I was working, I was very interested in starting a business, particularly to kind of diversify my income stream. And I looked at real estate and as an asset class, and I saw that, I think the most number of millionaires have been made through real estate. And I was like, okay, let me go and start buying rental property, and quickly realized I didn't have money as a recent graduate with no trust fund. So instead of trying to buy real estate, we had this idea where we were like, why don't we rent real estate? And why don't we turn it into an Airbnb? So we'd approach landlords with the offer that we would pay a little bit above market, lease their properties, and would essentially sublet it on Airbnb and arbitrage the assets. So if we would rent it for $3,000, we would make, in some cases, $4,000 or $5,000 a month in total rent. So $2,000 or so in profit.
Love it.
And in order to build the business, my co-founder and I had this idea where we like to do things and really immerse ourselves. So we were like, why don't we actually become leasing agents? And that way we can learn the property, learn the industry at the ground level.
Yeah.
And at the same time, every vacant property that this landlord had, we can turn into, at the time, the company was called Astro, an Astro unit. So my co-founder, having worked at SpaceX, decided to approach a landlord, offer to work for free, and to our dismay, got turned down. And he said, hey, you know, we both went to USC, we had engineering degrees, he worked at SpaceX, we're like, why not? And the conclusion was like, hey, guys, you're not in the industry, you don't know what it's like, and you know, we're just gonna go with somebody more senior. A week later, he calls frantically saying, somebody, one of their property managers absconded to Mexico and stole $500,000, we need you. You here next week.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he, in 1 week, moved to Redwood City, California, became a leasing agent for 9 months. And over those 9 months, we grew the business to about $2 million in revenue. And the owner, just seeing us kind of build this business, decided to invest $500,000. So he was the first investor. And that kind of gave us the confidence to quit our jobs and really expand this business. But 6 months later, COVID hit and completely destroyed hospitality, had a massive impact around the world. And we went from being a wildly profitable Airbnb business to losing $100,000 a month in 5 weeks. And immediately what we decided to do was play defense. And we said, people are not leasing short-term. Yeah. Let's sign new 12-month leases. And instead of trying to rent it short-term, let's just sign 12-month leases and rent it long-term. So the company pivoted into becoming a virtual leasing office. Everybody became leasing agents, including myself and my co-founder. And all we were trying to do was get these properties leased long-term. So we were calling, we were scheduling tours, we were doing whatever we could.
Were you still arbitraging because we
had the lease contracts for many of them. We had just recently expanded. So we had just signed a lot of these leases. And we were still arbitraging. So we were like, let's go back to renting it long-term. And thankfully in 2 months, we got most of the properties leased. We broke out of leases where we could, but we walked away from that experience realizing that Airbnb had kind of created this magical rental experience where you could go on this online platform, look at pictures and pay and just walk into the property, right? Whereas the long-term process was so manual with all these steps and it's exactly. So we kind of took that insight and realized that this industry was ripe for innovation. And we kind of took the problem set that we were dealing with, which is scheduling tours, leasing apartments, following up was so mundane and manual. And we looked to technology and we said, how could we build AI tooling to solve the problem that we were experiencing ourselves? And that kind of led to the origin story and the genesis of Zuma. And here we are 4.5 years later.
Wow. And so, you know, AI, like a lot of things, can be, we can spend a lot of time solving problems that don't need to be solved. So how do you guys take a look at the leasing side of things and figure out what needs to be solved? Or maybe even how do you prioritize what should be solved with AI?
I think for us, it was very easy, right? Because we had experienced the problem ourselves. I think the interesting thing about this industry is you have a bunch of, more often than not, I wouldn't say it's always the case, but you have folks that kind of come from tech or technology, but don't really have deep industry experience. But for us, we were solving the problem that we experienced directly. So I think having played the role of a leasing agent, having ran a property management company, we were able to identify kind of the key beachhead problem for us, which was you look at all these property management companies, they're spending, tons of money advertising and marketing dollars to acquire leads, but you have this kind of rate limit or a bottleneck where you get all these leads coming into your system, but deciphering signal from noise, understanding who the high intent renters are, is time consuming, is an omnipresent job. You have to do this 24/7, whether the leasing agent or on-site team is in office or not, somebody online is inquiring about your property. So we kind of took that insight in that really narrow problem and said, the only thing that we're going to do is tightly define this problem and then tightly solve it. So that's really how we started.
And then when you guys went to market, so did you guys go into market kind of right after COVID or during COVID?
Yeah. So 2020 June is, March is when everything, February is kind of when everything happened. It took us 2 or 3 months to kind of stabilize the business. We went through this 4 month period of I don't know what to do. What are we going to do? Should we go find jobs? And towards the fall of 2020, end of 2020, we went to market. So the way we went to market was pretty aggressive. We didn't know anybody in the industry. We didn't know the industry besides the smaller landlord that we knew. We decided to kind of rent an Airbnb in Palm Springs, and it was December at the time. But our goal was let's abstract our way ourselves from society. Let's just go in this Airbnb, and all we're going to do is cold call. At least for me, that's all I was doing. I would set up a little post-it note, and every day I'd wake up and I'd tally 150 till I went through 150 cold calls, and I did that for 4 months. And we were really fortunate to kind of find somebody at the right time, right place, got our first customer 45 days later that turned into 150K contract, and things kind of escalated from there.
The cold calling experience is interesting to kind of dig in on a little bit, because I find that especially the founders cold calling, the experience of cold calling is almost more valuable than the outcome of cold calling, because you actually figure out how to summarize your pitch on a voicemail. You figure out how to follow up, you figure out all those things, but just there's something about the way the brain works that when you write it on paper, but then you say it out loud, sometimes it just doesn't filter, it filters differently. And when you start talking about your offering, I imagine if you take your calls from day one or, and then look at your calls, even 2 weeks later, you would have sounded completely differently. You would have said things completely differently because you realize as you're saying it out loud in real time, because you're leaving voicemails most of the time. As leaving those voicemails, you're like, that sounds stupid. There's some voicemails I've left where I'm during the voicemail, and you just gotta go through that exercise because you need to have those reps around your value proposition. Otherwise, you're gonna waste everyone's time. And it's funny, you can deploy email sequences all day long and not have to kind of read it or feel it. But when you say those words out loud, when you're cold calling, you can start experiencing what your offer is, and you quickly edit that. Even in the day one, in the first, 25 calls, you've already edited your script.
Exactly. Yeah. It's kind of like when people say the best way to learn something is to teach it. It's because ultimately you're forced to practice it. So I think similarly with cold calling, when you get forced to move from the theoretical world of like, this is what I think I should say, to actually saying it, you kind of see you see the things that are working and not working. So I totally agree. I think, cold calling is one of those channels where you should, I think it works, right? But it's the way I see it is you're kind of, the little, the gophers or moles that like pop out and you have that hammer
whack-a-mole.
It's kind of like, whack-a-mole. Exactly. It's kind of like that where like you can get lucky when you kind of hit somebody on the head and they have the pain and they're experiencing it and you call them at the right time and all this stuff. But I think it's an inefficient way largely. I think the world we're moving in and what we're trying to employ at our business is trying to enrich our data. I think people move way too quickly to calling and emailing, and they don't do enough time actually enriching their data set, right?
Yep.
And really understanding the prospects that you're going after. And this isn't like, we go after people that have 1,000 units and that use Yardi and Entrata. That's like base level. Of course you should do that. But how could you go even deeper? How can you deepen your data set so you understand what are the signals? Are they hiring for leasing agents? Do they have open job positions? What is their occupancy rate? And we're still figuring out how to get really rich here. But I think the idea is the list is the message. In other words, how can you get the list so tight that it sells itself, because you're targeting the people that actually have that problem in the first place. And I think many people skip over that step, but I think we're moving in a world where AI is enabling outreach at scale. People are getting increasingly spammed, and you're going to have to be much more intelligent on how you actually engage in outbound to prospects. And I think that starts with the data and enriching your data to make it more effective.
I'm feeling that right now. Like some of the things that we've noticed in terms of outbound is that when I took a look at like in outbound channels where you have limits, like say for example, LinkedIn, right? You have 150 invites you can do per person, you can do a week. And then you can do like, let's say on average, 150 in mails a month, right? So you don't want to waste that, right? You don't want to scale that out in mails in a way that you're just kind of like burning it with generic outreach. You want to be specific about it. And then because you've added scarcity to the unit of output, like the outreach, the engagement, you're going to be a little bit more cerebral about it versus email. You might have like your email health to worry about, and that's about it. Other than that, people go to the moon, right? And so this is kind of like the absence of scarcity in email outbound creates just volumes and volumes of junk, and we'll see what happens. And so we're trying to figure out that balance right now, like, because we're doing campaigns that are both like, I'll do an email campaign paired with a LinkedIn campaign at the same time. So then at least I'm kind of like popping up in their wherever they're looking. Cause you never know if they actually, they generally are going to get, they're not going to open up past the subject line. They might, if it's kind of like hooky enough, but you might want to show up in their LinkedIn feed or do what we're doing right now. So that they're there, but all those things are all happening all in real time. So you can kind of begin to get, just be like we were talking to Tony Souza last week, just like be in their attention screen, right? And so that's kind of stuff that's an interesting perspective on how to break through right now and create awareness around the products that we sell,
Totally. That makes sense.
When you're out there talking, when you're out there hooking or trying to get up hooking, when you're out there trying to, reach people, this kind of next conversation around getting to hell yes is around finding the problem that they're seeking to solve when they're seeking to solve that problem. How do you guys figure that out from a leasing perspective? What's your kind of like, what's a strategy to even get closer to those people that are seeking to solve that problem at that moment?
Yeah. So that's the challenge that around the data, right? Is like, how do you, like, I think a good way to do this is to go through, 20 of your most recent, sales call. So we use Fathom as our note taker.
Yeah,
you can search in Fathom. You can search in Fathom and like check pain points and and identify what are the big pain points. Another tool I'm exploring is Notebook LM, which is really cool. It's like you can create your own database, throw YouTube links, throw whatever you want, and then it becomes searchable. But I think the first step would be to understand what are the buying signals for somebody. So why does somebody even buy your product? What pain are they experiencing? Obviously, they're experiencing some set or subset of pains that are encouraging them to go and buy your product. So I think obviously the first step is really being clear on what are those pains. The second step I think is data, figuring out how to get really rich data, because data is your signal into that pain. So for example, if we as an AI leasing agent company that builds tooling to automate mundane and manual processes across property management, one of our products is an AI leasing agent. If a customer has a property or multiple properties that are sub 70% occupancy, and they have a bunch of leasing agent job positions open, that's pretty clear signal to me that like they might need help, right? Or we run secret shops and we go inquire on 100 of their properties and see what their average response time is. And if their average response time is 3 days versus 2 minutes, we see within our data set that within an hour, the half-life of a lead is about an hour. So within an hour, you're 50% less likely to actually get a response. So I think looking at the data, I wouldn't say we have a perfect answer, but really understanding what signals you can identify through public information that will help enrich your probability of actually landing and getting lucky to find a customer that actually has a problem. Because if you think about it, right? Like, let's say you have a team of BDRs and they're cold calling and you have 1,000 prospects. The efficiency is really low if you don't have clear signal. They're just going through that list and calling people. But the tighter you can make the list, let's say you go from 1,000 to now 100 because you've enriched your understanding of who is experiencing pain, the hit rate is going to be much higher. The use of time is going to be much higher. Your team as you scale is going to be much more efficient, right? So I think people kind of, especially as you scale your sales team, the common consensus has been like, let's just scale people. Where I think we need to pause and actually like figure out how to just run more effectively as a business and increase your output per unit time spent.
Yeah, your realization. Totally agreed. I think that's one of the nice things. I'll say one of the nice things. One of the interesting things about having constraints in the startup world is that you're forced to think things through a little bit more efficiently. And so I agree with you there. And then that like the outbound motion needs to be more prescribed than just like, push it out there. Because if you're especially in a startup context where you've got to target buyers that are likely to buy, and that you have to understand why they would buy you, right? Why would they choose you versus the other alternatives that are out there? And the alternative kind of concept is an interesting one to poke at a little or pull at. And I learned this from a good friend of mine, Rob Schneider, talking about like the alternatives that people choose to solve that problem. So in your case, the leasing problem. So if I'm going to solve a leasing problem, so how am I going to solve that problem conventionally? I might hire subcontractors. I might hire leasing agents. And if I don't, what am I going to do? Right? I might choose technology. I might take an ad out. Like those are the things that you're competing against most of the time. And the conventional way of solving most problems is hiring. And so your point that you brought up about the job postings, like I'm following the same lead as you. Like I take job postings right now, and I'll even take job postings of my prospects or my prospect. Sorry. I'll take job postings that my prospects have posted. I throw that in a GPT and I test my language all the time against those job postings. So I'll pick it from, let's take the top 10 companies. I'll go look for a regional maintenance manager of the top 10 companies, put that in a GPT, and that would be my composite. But I'll pull in a regional manager, an asset manager, I'll pull in a portfolio manager from BTR SFR, I'll pull in a maintenance tech, and I'll actually test my pitch against the GPT and say, okay, this pitch here, who's this going to hit most likely? And asset manager buy it for this reason, regional buy it for this reason, maintenance quarter buy it for this reason, but the economic buyer is probably going to be this person because of these reasons, right? And you're using the data that the market's freely giving you. And so then now that I have that, like when I do outbound on a, like say on a LinkedIn basis, I'm actually getting really specific around who we're going to target, their role versus the job postings that are out there. So the job posting not only is a vector-based indicator, but also a directional-based indicator on who is going to be likely the one to buy for that company. And I'm finding that to be very helpful when I look to scale out, because I'm hiring somebody starting on Friday. And basically, I'm going to hand them this GPT and say, hey, here's the GPT that we've been tuning for our audience, and this is what they're looking for. And then, you know, the next step is to what you're doing is, if I can look for job postings and I know they're seeking to solve the pain that we solve using a conventional way, and they've already got budget allocated to it, there's already a number out there, and say, hey, you're going to go hire a $75,000 maintenance coordinator or maintenance technician. Well, what, you know, would you consider this? You know, and you don't even enter that conversation. They've got to kind of like bring that forward as a, oh, geez, well, now I don't have to hire that maintenance coordinator or tech or whatever. Like, that's part of the problems that we're really seeking to solve. So it's great to hear the inverse of it. And I am frustrated, because it would be great to be able to look at who's hiring what types of jobs. You can just see who's hiring. But like, that would be a great signal for someone to build in terms of like what types of jobs are being hired by certain companies. And then you can filter on that.
Yeah. Yeah. There's this new role that's becoming increasingly popular. I don't know if you've heard of it, but like the go-to-market engineer, right? And the go-to-market engineer is responsible for really like increasing, I think, efficiency of your data and understanding what signals are leading to buyers and getting that really tight. So yeah, I agree.
Yeah. But there are all these different little things of trying to figure out what they're using. You know, what we're trying to figure out is what other alternatives do they have to solve the problem that we solve, and how do they signal that they're solving that problem, right? And that's how we get kind of closer to those that are actively in a pain point, right? They're actively seeking alternatives. Totally. When you take a look at your buyers who are out there, your audience, I mean, again, you mentioned a little bit around like they're posting jobs, they've got open leases, they're posting ads. When you narrow in on them, how do you bump them from their conventional approach to solving a problem?
So if I'm understanding the question correctly, how do you encourage them to take a decision to actually solve the problem rather than just stay with status quo? Or like,
well, maybe the more, you can rephrase the question. Around like, let's, if they've posted a job, if they've got a building that's under lease, that's leasing, and they've got a job posting for leasing agent, they're in the pain. They're exhibiting pain, but they may have a mindset around solving it a certain way. So how do you get them? What kind of tactics do you guys use, or language do you use, or story do you use to bring them along to thinking about doing it a different way?
Yeah. I think there's this book called The Jolt Effect.
Yep.
And the Jolt. Yeah. Our sales leader introduced it to me, and I thought it was pretty interesting. He said the biggest reason, I'm gonna butcher this, but I think the biggest reason that people are scared to make decisions is because they're weighing the cost of like how this is gonna look on them in some way, right? They don't want to mess up the decision. So I think the biggest thing is, you know, this is table stakes, but like piloting, right? Like reducing the risk wherever you can for them. So introducing a pilot where they can actually see the product firsthand and actually experience the product firsthand, I think is one step. I think the important thing also is education, right? I think in my opinion, it is much more risky as a property management company to not use AI than it is to use AI, and understanding the implicit risk of defaulting out of using technology. Because if you are competing against all your all the other property management companies in your area, and they're using tooling to operate more efficiently, the leads that you're foregoing are going to your competitors. So I think understanding the implicit risk of opting out, right? Like sometimes people say, if it's not broken, don't fix it. But the reality is like the gravitational pull of technology is making everything more efficient. And if you're opting out of that process, it's kind of like you're there's a real risk to your business because of that, right? So I think educating them there and letting them actually see the product and experience the product firsthand. One thing we've also experimented too with is Historically, the industry has been really focused around per unit pricing. So you have a tool, it's going to be a couple dollars a unit, whatever it is. But the problem with that is that it actually doesn't really align the incentives, right? So the buyer and the seller's incentives are not aligned. So one of the things we're exploring is, can we actually create a new pricing model, which is more outcome-based pricing? So if you see value, you will pay for that value. If you get tours scheduled on your calendar that are qualified and high intent, then you pay for the value that was delivered to you, right? Mm-hmm. So realigning pricing to have incentives more aligned is something that we think will also accelerate sales cycles and also encourage encourage buyers to make decisions where they wouldn't otherwise.
Mm-hmm. I have been kind of like dripping into conversations that have that lens to it. And we're thinking, and I've got to do a pricing for tomorrow. We're thinking of putting together a mix of a base load and then upside, right? So that we can kind of like, we can share in the upside, because there is like, in this, Dixon talks about this, the Jolt effect is like, there's like the emotional risks that needs to be hurdled. And then there's the economic risk. And the economic risk is usually like kind of like the secondary to the emotional risk or career risk. So if you can kind of hurdle over the emotional risk and then hurdle over the career risk, then you get a chance to battle on the economic risk. And the economic risk is when someone else comes in and they're challenging the decision that maybe somebody's already made, you know, like I'll call it the CFO, CFNO role. Whereas if you can de-risk it for that person, then you've already bought in the emotional side of things. And now you can kind of activate the ROI piece, the economic risk. And like, we can put together a pricing model that makes sure we're not losing money on a baseload basis. So you're committed. Because we used to put in like pilot fees. We had pilot fees in place because we want to make sure we're not just doing all this work for someone that's just curious. We want to make sure we're certainly solving a problem. So we're trying to get agreement on the metrics that matter before we kick off, you know, any engagement. First 90 days, we want to make sure what metric are we going to talk about in 90 days? Because I want you to, we really want you to be celebrating this decision. And so let's find out that economic, that emotional hurdle. We've got a hurdle. Let's de-risk it from an economic perspective so that you can bring your stakeholders aligned. And then let's make that how we rally. There's one thing that we've learned as well. Is that if you don't have that metric that matters that you're trying to move towards, let's say, for example, you bring in somebody who's really enthusiastic and they kind of get a little flaky along the way and the usage is dropping. Like, how do you rally them back if you don't have an agreement on what that metric means?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's setting expectations and clarity. We even went so far as to almost consider like, we called it like a map, a mutual action plan, right? Where we'd lay everything out. We didn't quite get there, but I'm curious to know what you think is almost like signing that, right? It's like, hey, here's the expectations that we think are reasonable. Here's what you expect from us. If this happens, then here's what we hope that the relationship would lead to. Usually what I feel like folks do is they may or may not outline that. In the case that they do, they'll send it. But we're also thinking like, hey, like, let's actually just sign that, you know, let's both sign it and like, let's agree on it. It doesn't contractually hold you, but I think the act of signing it and showing that this is like something you really want to commit to, I think is actually more impactful than, because people feel like they're putting their name on it. They're really bought in now.
I do like that. That's good. We have not tried that. We called it MVP, the mutual value plan. But like, I do like that approach of actually signing it off, because then you're like, you're committed. It's not just a meeting. It's not just a meeting anymore.
Yeah. Like, imagine this, right? Like, let's say you made a promise to somebody, and you know, your friend was like, "Hey, like, let's just sign this paper." You're definitely going to be more likely to like actually do it because it just feels like more of a commitment, right? And it's this emotional thing, and it doesn't contractually hold you to anything. But I think it's like one of those like psychological things that it just shows that you're extra committed. It really like puts your name on it. So
I found that, you know, the interesting thing where we kind of like get hesitation in that kind of approach is that in larger organizations, you know, many decision makers are unwilling to sign anything, or many people who are like, sorry, I'll put it this way. Many people that are in the project team are unwilling to sign anything because they've never been a signatory before. And so like, we'll have a maintenance director, right? They're like, I don't sign that stuff. Why would I sign that? Right. And so it's interesting to kind of like put that sophistication, that kind of commitment at play and paperize it. I love that. I got to see if we can test that out and just say, hey, if you're interested, with some customers, we'd sign off the MVP and that's what we're going to march towards. And that way gives us a chance to check on that in 90 days. How does that sound?
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, I love it. It's committing enough that, I mean, it's a signature, it's a non-binding signature, but it's to your point, it's that emotional
pseudo commitment. Exactly.
Yeah. I love it. When you guys are looking at your market and you're segmenting all your people out and you're using your data, how do you characterize that hell yes buyer? Like, where do you find that they're choosing the fastest or making a decision the quickest?
I mean, it just comes down to pain, right? It's like, It depends on the product, but let's say we have a collections product too, right? So we build tooling to help, you know, property manager companies before they send it to collections and pay 20-25%, whatever it is, we'll try to collect, we'll send rent reminders, we'll do promise to pay dates, etc. Like let's say somebody has a fire issue with collections and, you know, they have very high delinquency, like, and you happen to call them or email them or, you know, connect with them at that time, of course they're hell yes, and they're excited to explore it. And I've been in that situation a couple times too. So I think it really just like, I think the answer is dependent on the person's business and the pain points they're solving. But I think it's pretty straightforward. It's like, what are the pain points you solve? And are those pain points exceptionally sharp for that buyer? And if they are, and you happen to meet them at that time, it's going to be a hell yes.
But it would be ideal if we could filter on those hell yes criteria, right? Like the outstanding AR is something that's not going to be available on a tradable, you know, but like what we're trying to figure out is what are the signals? Because there's kind of macro signals that everyone knows about, but don't really action on. And then there's kind of like what's happening in my business this quarter that they need to solve. And right now we're heading into busy season on the maintenance side of things. And so people are realizing right now they don't have enough people, like in real time. They're like, I don't have enough people to do all the work all of a sudden. And then, I've got enough work to do all the work I planned out, but I've made no allocation for our unplanned work, which is like 40% of the work. So they're hooped. And so like those kind of things are like, you know, we're trying to figure out how to find those people. Yeah. And so a bit of it now. I'm taking this course, strategic coach Dan Sullivan, and like he's talking about like think about the business as though you're a buyer as well. So let me play this through, and I'm trying to think of this way in terms of you and our outbound is like if you were to create a wanted ad for your hell yes customer, what would that wanted ad look like? And so like I'm doing a pitch at AIM, and I'm thinking of my clothes. And like, what's my ask? And it's like, if you are these things, if you are suffering through this, this, or this, you look like this, I'd like to talk to you about your business. Instead of like spraying, instead of like having a wide aperture, having a rifle aperture and saying, this is what I look for. And then with this, the concept is that by having a rifle aperture, people will actually self-qualify to 3 out of 4 of those criteria. Because that's enough conviction around the problem and they'll opt in. And so I think of it that way a little
in
bit
your outbound. Are you saying that in your outbound or where, outbound, where
yeah.
you're like, having rifle aperture?
Yeah. So rifle aperture so that we're actually looking at asking questions in the outbound that relate to qualification. So it isn't like, hey, I wonder if you want to talk about this. It's like, we're solving this problem for these people. Is that you? Because we can't filter on the available data on who's hiring, right? Because I can't find that data, or I can't act that data, or I don't have time to import it and do all those things with it. But I can ask them directly, we solve this for this. Is that you? And then experiment with that a little bit. It's kind of it's a bit of a mind bender, but I do like this approach of thinking that we're also sellers are buyers as well. And so a real magical scenario is if the buyer is seeking to solve a problem and we are qualifying those buyers with a, let's say a mutual criteria.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think the problem though, Guillermo, at least from our side, I'd be curious to know what you think is like, people are just not responding to emails the same way or even opening it up. Like here's my thesis, right? Like I can have a burning problem and somebody can send me an email, but my brain has just automatically rejected those emails that I'm not even opening them, right? I don't pick up my phone. And it's funny, and some people do in this industry, and thankfully we're in real estate where it's more people driven and they do pick up the phone sometimes. But I think the challenge is we've been in circumstances, you know, I have a podcast similar to you, where my sales team will tell me that like, hey, I've reached out to this person like 10 times for the last 6 months, calling them every month, sending them emails. Yeah. And I reach out to them for the podcast and I introduce the idea of the podcast and I tell them about it. And they're like, oh yeah, like, you know, your salesperson is reaching out to me. Like, let me schedule a demo with them. And it's only like been able to connect with them in a way that is outside of their normal inbound, right? Yeah. Like a podcast or something.
It's also an offer instead of an ask, right? Yeah. It's a similar conversation that we're trying to do is we figure out what can I offer instead of what can I ask for?
Yeah.
That's just a reciprocity law, right? So if I'm offering something, then maybe that's a little bit more. And the offers, and even what's funny is that we even filter offers these days, you know, like free Yeti mug, all these sorts of things, like we get them all the time. And so the filter on time is much more obvious. And it's interesting you talk about email. Like I open my email once a day. I don't even look at it anymore. Because I've got the data that's coming from like HubSpot. I get bings from HubSpot, bings from LinkedIn. You know, the email thing is like really if it's I'm getting a notification through HubSpot that I know it's deal related, and if it's not deal related, it can wait. And so you know, go ahead.
Yeah. One of the frameworks that I use. Is I think people are so used to selling and then building a relationship where I think it's actually more intelligent to actually build relationships and then let selling unfold. Some of our biggest deals have been from people that have basically been like, Shiv, I see you at all these conferences. I feel like we've talked, like, what the hell do you do? Like, what do you do? You haven't even told me what you do. And then I'm like, oh yeah, like this is what we do. And they're like, awesome. Like, wow, I didn't know that. I was looking for an AI product, blah, blah, blah. And I think immediately what that does is like you separate yourself from the pack of being this like annoying ass salesperson that's like, you know, just like pinging people. And you do have to follow up and there is a place for that. But I think what's more smart is like, you know, even with the podcast, right? Like the way I think about it is like, I genuinely do care about people's stories and I love doing the podcast and it's such a strong passion project. And at the same time, I think it's an opportunity to actually just like heat up the entire market, build relationships, and like popcorn in a microwave, it'll pop when the time is right. But now I'm out here like heating up the entire market. People know who I am. They know what we're doing. And like maybe a year from now, they're like, oh yeah, like we're looking to get an AI tool. Like, oh yeah, I know Shiv. Like, let me message him. Right.
Well, so I find it's like, I think of it in terms of like the billboard, right? The billboard to me is still a mysterious way of spending money. Cause it's like, rarely is anybody in their moment of purchase when you drive past a billboard on the I whatever, like you're not stopping right there to buy something, but it's just that it's that constant reminder of entering that person's attention space and reminding them about something. And it can be, you know, any number of things. And so I think email is trying to replace that by just constantly being in the top of the inbox, but it's like, it's not really valuable. Same as the billboard, but it's just there. And the reality, I guess, and the thing is that what everyone will agree with is that email is annoying and it works. And so cold calling is annoying and it works. So if you can figure out the numbers of it to make it more effective and not feel so like, just like grimy about it, then it's like, it kind of starts to work a little bit. So we're trying to figure out that mix. And I think everyone is, because email is becoming, it is effective with respect to, you can get lists, you can send out messages, it forces you to frame that message, But you know, who's opening it up? I mean, you get, when you get 1% open rate and people are like, wow, that's pretty good. You're like, no, it's not possible. Like,
yeah, possible? I think it's a losing game. I think my thinking, and part of the reason why we're doing things somewhat unconventionally with this RV and traveling the country and doing this in-person podcast, is like, there are two ways to win. You can like be the best at a losing game, or you can find a game that you're going to win by default, right?
Repaint the lines. Change the lines in the field.
Exactly. And I think our goal here at Zuma is like, how do we build games and set ourselves up so we're going to win by default? And I think that means product, that means sales, that means marketing, that means every function of your business. You always want to think about setting yourself up so that the environment or the situation that you set yourself up in, you're just going to win by default.
Mm-hmm. I think because you're the only player in the game.
Exactly.
Yeah. So just in terms of kind of halfway through, we're just past midway here. So a recap. So around the problem that we solved around leasing, right? The hell yes buyer is someone who's seeking alternatives for their current, or they're trying to solve a leasing problem. And they show that by, you know, they've got the low, a lease up ads out there. They've got their jobs that they're seeking to hire for. You guys can go in there and have a conversation about a different way of solving the problem. The solutions that they typically use to solve this problem is hiring more people, subbing it out. We kind of chatted about that already. The next one kind of get into is objections. Like, all these things, what kind of objections do you guys typically hear?
It depends on the buyer, but it's a wide range. I mean, a lot of it is around like technology, like not wanting to adopt AI as a whole, mm-hmm. right? There's just certain buyers that are just like not willing to adopt AI. And maybe they're a little bit more traditional in that sense. I think another big thing is like confusing products, right? Like not understanding. I think it's an extremely difficult time to be a buyer. I will say that in property management, because there are so many solutions that look so similar that you as a buyer are getting kind of infiltrated with all these products. And it's actually very challenging to understand what are the high signal products from all the noise that exists out there. So I think one big thing is unintentionally, and this might be just incumbent on the seller to make sure they're educating properly, but you know, sometimes people come on and confuse the feature set or capability of a multiple products. They'll conflate one product with another, and it'll be a totally different feature set, because it does require a lot of education. Sometimes it's difficult to do that on a 30-minute call. So sometimes they may leave, you know, being like, oh yeah, this is like a chatbot, or this is like this is something else. So I think like just the wide landscape of products that buyers have to kind of sift through is a big challenge. And then I would say just general resistance to technology. But candidly, Guillermo, I think it all comes down to like objections, as in like, it's just not a priority for them at the time, right? Like it's just not a priority.
Well, I find to your first statement, I find that SEO is partly to blame for us commingling all our solutions. Because like, you know, we're part of a centralized maintenance suite or program, because we want to catch people looking for centralized maintenance because they're talking about it and writing about it and searching about it. But like, ultimately, we're not going to be an entire end-to-end centralized maintenance solution, because that would be other things that we don't do. But it's like, at least this is what we're trying. You got to catch them with what they're searching for, because they don't know how to articulate our solution. No one would type in, I'm looking for telemaintenance or remote maintenance. They would just wouldn't type that in. It's just not conventional. And so I need to think about what the buyer is searching. So they might search for common things that people are talking about on podcasts or whatever. And so the problem with that, though, is that then you're in the attention like frame, but you're in the wrong box. So you kind of like, you got introduced, but you're in the wrong room kind of thing, you know? And that's the part that like, and then you get mixed up. Well, we already have an AI maintenance solution. Do you really? Yeah, this is what we do. We have one, or we haven't turned it on. And you kind of like dig in on that a little bit, because the product suites that are out there, they generally have, you know, if you're doing that kind of like that grid, they generally have a tick box for almost everything, but they may not do it well. And that's what we're trying to exploit. And it's like,
yeah.
You know, they'll say, you know, Yardi, it's the biggest. Well, Yardi does that. Don't we have, a Yardi? They're like, why aren't you using it? You kind of dig into some of those questions, but I'm with you, and we've got to figure out the way to catch them by what they're searching for, which makes us lend towards kind of like common language. Mm-hmm. And then when we land them, we've got to differentiate on the way we solve that problem and how it's different.
Yeah.
And that's the part, that's the part that's confusing to the buyer.
It is. Yeah. And I think this is actually a business specific problem set. So I think it's incumbent on the buyer to actually understand what are the biggest levers to your business, right? Let's say leasing and leasing velocity is a huge funnel, a huge rate limiting blocker to revenue and occupancy for your business, mm-hmm. right? In that case, it should be incumbent upon you to choose the best of breed solution, because the delta between the median solution and the best solution is enough to actually move the business in a way that's positive, because the lever on your particular business within your context is a strong lever. But let's say there's another issue that, let's say, collections or delinquency is, you're at 99% collections, right? Does it matter if you use X mainstream product versus Y super niche product? I don't think so as much, right? And I think it's incumbent on the buyer to really understand what are the biggest levers to improve your business. And in those cases, I would default to choosing best of breed, because that's a huge lever to actually move your business forward.
I use this metaphor to that similar analogy a couple weeks back. And this goes back to this is systems architecture thing. Is there's systems of record and there's systems of engagement. Mm-hmm. Systems of record are supposed to move slow. Systems of engagement are supposed to move fast. And they shouldn't try and mix. And when systems of record try to do system engagement work, they tick the box, but really poorly. And it prevents buyers from seeking alternatives that actually can solve the problem. And here's kind of I hope everyone catches this image, is the roots of a tree grow very slowly. But if they did not grow slow, and if they grew quickly, the tree would not be very stable. But if the roots weren't growing slowly, seeking water and nutrients, the tree itself would be very, very unstable and wouldn't grow. Right? The soil is unstable. And so you think about that metaphor of systems of engagement are the leaves of the tree that collect the nutrients, collect the sunshine, all that stuff, and funnels it into the trunk, funnels it into the tree, into the roots, so the roots can grow and be stable. But you can't have them both. They just don't do good jobs. They don't do the job that it needs to be done all the way. Your roots can't collect the sunshine. It just doesn't do that. And so what we're finding is that, particularly as we get in this world of integrations, best of breed platform products, we're trying to find partners that understand their role as a system of record, because those partners when I match up what we solve against those systems of record, it helps us frame our product roadmap, because I know that I'm not going to compete against free, right? There's solutions out there that do 30 cents a work order. Well, I'm not going to create a better work order because it's already near free. So I don't want that business, but I need to solve something else that I can map into their business so I don't create more pain.
Yeah.
There's a long way of describing it, but that's kind of I hope that's what you're saying.
Yeah, I like that analogy, actually. We've done a lot of thought here on the broader landscape and where the company is headed. And we actually see it very similarly, but I think there's this third system that is emerging that people are not talking about, but I think we're kind of going out to build, which is the system of action. So if you look at system of record, you have the PMSs, systems of engagement, you have tooling and all that stuff. I think the system of action, I think the future of software is actually building conscious software, where software actually understands your problem and will actually take action autonomously to solve that problem. For example, if you look at a system of record, a system of record by definition is a box to hold data and to keep that data there, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not conscious. It's not.
Yeah, it's a receiver. It's a receiver.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think software needs to be more conscious. I think software needs to get to a place where you have all this data and all these silos, all of these systems and all these point solutions that are kind of put into one system where you can actually make intelligent decisions and the system will actually start taking action for you. John Smith just like did a maintenance order and it sounds like the request was solved. And, you know, based on our text conversation, he seems really pleased.
Yeah.
Maybe we should send him a review request right now. You know, as a human user, yes, I approve that. Boom. And I feel like software needs to be more conscious. It needs to start making decisions that we won't be able to do otherwise. That's a basic example, but I think a more complex example is surfacing insights by way of connecting and synergizing systems to give you an insight on a decision that you may not see just by looking at one.
Well, and ideally, like that example there, it's not forcing the decision, it's actually making a recommendation. Right. So in that example, it's not suggesting, hey, should you send a survey? It's say, we recommend you send a survey to John because John just gave us this review. And then that would be the, or this other event. And so that would be the recommendation. And then the humans are just kind of quality assuring because we've got to bridge that gap of confidence the recommendation is right. And maybe tune the ML a little bit. But I'm with you as well. I love that idea. Like we've got our kind of like our reason for being. How we want to map that to an automation thing, and then we want to hand it off to system record, you know, because we don't want to compete with free or whatever everyone else has already bought. And so that's kind of like, I love that concept of system of action, because that's the outer fringes. So you think of that, carry the metaphors of like circles or whatever, there's more surface area around that fringe, but it's just not as wide, you know. And so the area of that circle, not the internal side of it, the radius of that is worth mining, and that's where a lot of value can be uncovered, because we're not going to create a better Yardi. It'd be very hard to do that, and so let's acknowledge that that's what it is and work with it. So I love that thinking. I'm gonna think on that for a bit and kind of like add there. I love it.
And I think, and just to add to that really quickly, I think like this isn't necessarily like, ideally, this system will make decisions that you would not be making or your team would not be making otherwise, right? That would be the goal, is unlocking this net new set of decisions or recommendations that will actually add a lot of value to your business, because it's integrating all this information and seeing things that you can't see just by operating. So,
You know, it's interesting, and I'll follow on that. We've got a feature that we don't, it is a system of action feature, but we don't think about it that way. So it's kind of lost and buried in the rest of the stuff that we do. But I really like how you brought that up. And where I'm going with this is that the problem that feature solves is the decisions are inconsistent in the human context. So humans, given the scope of information they have, make the decision based on what they understand or how they're understanding. But if we can use AI to make recommendations and decisions that's consistent and uniform, we have a lot less problems and less variability. You can get towards a predictable outcome. And so, I want that soak for a bit, because the idea of a system of action can start solving some of those decisions that are inconsistently applied, maybe lack the knowledge to be able to make that ruling, leasing has a ton of them that are just native to leasing and the problem that leasing happens. So that's a good one. I like that. So we're going to wrap this up. So in terms of one piece of advice, so talking through your former life or talking to your former self or someone that's coming in to your company, what's the bit of advice that you give them to get them going in terms of helping to find people who are hell yes?
For sales specifically or career? I'm a big believer that when you're first starting, you don't really have a network. And as you kind of progress in your career, you build that network and that network creates leverage. But really the two inputs you have to producing great work is leverage and then just the sheer input metrics, like whether that's through calls, emails, whatever. Ideally, you can kind of take your leverage and use your input metrics and create a much stronger impact. But I think when you don't have leverage, you really have to do lean on input metrics, right? So for me, I believe that like when you're first starting out, I think working harder is usually more powerful than working smarter. Yeah. Because you don't really know how to work smart because you don't know. So, you know, for us, we just brute forced it, right? Like it's just putting in the hours and, you know, it might feel like whack-a-mole where you get lucky, but if you do it enough and you get lucky, that creates the right momentum for you, your business, your sales career, whatever. If you're an account executive at a company, it's very hard to lose your job if you're somebody that is just like driving input metrics and doing whatever you can to build pipelines. So I think my advice to people just starting out is like, just like really put in the work and focus, right? Focus and block time. I think you'd be surprised how much you can get done in like a 2 hour or 3 hour, like deep focus block of just sitting and calling uninterrupted versus like having some colleague come talk to you, getting up and going for lunch and walking around, all the stuff, just like lock in for four hours and you get it quite a bit done. So I don't know, I'd say like in the early days, you just got to brute force it and that's okay. And that brute force will lead to a better network, will lead to momentum and will allow you to then use leverage to multiply your impact. But I think input metrics and just working with intensity is pretty important in the early days.
Mm-hmm. And definitely measuring those input the outcomes of the input metrics, right? You're kind of tweaking to get the more opens, to get the more calls, get the more meetings, get the more conversions, all those things.
Love exactly.
That. Awesome. How can folks get a hold of you? What's the best way?
LinkedIn, Shiv Getu. I'm fairly active now on LinkedIn. You can check out the podcast, Humans of Multifamily. We interview everybody from, you know, regional managers, the vice presidents, the CEOs to CMOs on kind of their personal story. So how they got in the industry, why they are the way they are. We talk a little bit about thought leadership and industry insights, but I'd say LinkedIn is the best way.
Your guest roster is outstanding. It's inspired that level. It's awesome. You did a good job there. In a very quick amount of time, you did a very good job. Outstanding. Okay, cool. And then who should we talk to next on this show?
Have you talked to Mike Wolber?
Mike Wolber. From
Apartment List.
No.
Sales officer at Apartment List.
I got to talk to him. Yes.
Talk to Mike. Mike is sharp. He's big on LinkedIn. He'll definitely do this. So talk to Mike. Yeah.
We'll ping Mike. That's great. Thanks very much for today, Des. Outstanding to hear your thoughts. Really good conversation. Appreciate how we kind of like just kind of deviate a little bit philosophically around how we're doing things. It's fun to chat and have those conversations. That's what I do. Love this show for that. I love doing it live because we get to kind of deviate a little bit and experiment in ideas. Thanks for listening today. If you're listening to the podcast, subscribe, hit the subscribe on Apple or on Spotify and add your comments or your feedback. That's always helpful for Lyft and visibility. Shiv, thank you so much today for coming. Outstanding. Thanks for everyone listening to the live show. What a great time to share ideas and kind of look at what we're doing in the future. Thank you very much.
Awesome. Cheers, man. Thanks.
Take care, everyone. Cheers. And we're good.